husband died. So off they went.
Yes, via UPS from a warehouse in Terre Haute. A very small recoupment, but something. We do what we can for our clients, Mr. Hodges.
I'm sure you do. And we all say hooray, Hodges thinks.
Do you recall the address those 800 Zappets went to?
No, but it will be in the files. Give me your email, and I'll be happy to send it to you, on condition you call me back and tell me what sort of scam these games people have been working.
Happy to do that, Mr. Schneider.
It'll be a box number, Hodges thinks, and the box holder will be long gone. Still, it will need to be checked out. Holly can do it while he's in the hospital getting treatment for something that almost certainly can't be cured.
You've been very helpful, Mr. Schneider. One more question and I'll let you go. Do you happen to remember the name of the Games Unlimited CEO?
Oh, yes, Schneider says. I assume that's why the company was Games with a Z instead of an S.
I don't follow.
The CEO's name was Myron Zakim.
14. Hodges hangs up and opens Firefox. He types in Z the end and finds himself looking at a cartoon man swinging a cartoon pickaxe. Clouds of dirt fly up, forming the same message over and over.
Sorry, we're still under construction, but keep checking back.
We are made to persist. That's how we find out who we are. Tobias Wolff.
Another idea worthy of Reader's Digest, Hodges thinks, and goes to his window. Morning traffic on Lower Marlboro is moving briskly. He realizes, with wonder and gratitude, that the pain in his side has entirely disappeared for the first time in days. He could almost believe nothing is wrong with him, but the bitter taste in his mouth contradicts that. The bitter taste, he thinks. The residue. His cell rings. It's Norma Wilmer, her voice pitched so low he has to strain to hear.
If this is about the so-called visitors list, I haven't had a chance to look for it yet. This place is crawling with police and cheap suits from the district attorney's office. You'd think Hartsfield escaped instead of died.
It's not about the list, although I still need that info, and if you can get it to me today, it's worth another $50. Get it to me before noon and I'll make it 100.
Jesus, what's the big deal with this? I asked Georgia Frederick. She's been bouncing back and forth between Ortho and the Bucket for the last 10 years, and she says the only person she ever saw visiting Hartsfield besides you was some ratty chick with tattoos and a marine haircut.
This rings no bells with Hodges, but there is a faint vibration, which he doesn't trust. He wants to put this thing together too badly, and that means he must step with special care.
What do you want, Bill? I'm in a fucking linen closet. It's hot, and I've got a headache.
My old partner called and told me Brady swallowed some shit and killed himself. What that says to me is he must have stockpiled enough dope over time to do it. Is that possible?
It is. It's also possible I could land a 767 jumbo jet if the whole flight crew died of food poisoning, but both things are very fucking unlikely. I'll tell you what I told the cops and the two most annoying yappers from the DA's office. Brady got Anaprox DS on PE days, one pill with food before, one late in the day if he asked, which he rarely did. Anaprox isn't really much more powerful when it comes to controlling pain than Advil, which you can buy OTC. He also had extra-strength Tylenol on his chart, but only asked for it on a few occasions.
How did the DA guys react to that?
Right now, they're operating under the theory that he swallowed a shitload of Anaprox.
But you don't buy it?
Of course I don't! Where would he hide that many pills? Up his bony bedsword ass? I have to go. I'll get back to you on the visitors list, if there ever was one, that is.
Thank you, Norma. Try some Anaprox for that headache of yours.
Fuck you, Bill.
But she says it with a laugh.
15.
The first thought to cross Hodges' mind when Jerome walks in is, holy shit, kiddo, you grew up. When Jerome Robinson came to work for him, first as a kid who cut his grass, then as an all-around handyman, finally as the tech angel who kept his computer up and running, he was a weedy teenager, going about 5'8 and 140 pounds. The young giant in the doorway is 6'2" if he's an inch, and at least 190. He was always good-looking, but now he's movie star good-looking and all muscled out. The subject in question breaks into a grin, strides quickly across the office, and embraces Hodges. He squeezes, but lets go in a hurry when he sees Hodges wince.
Jesus, sorry.
You didn't hurt me. Just happy to see you, my man.
His vision is a little blurry, and he wipes at his eyes with the heel of his hand.
You're a sight for sore eyes.
You too. How you feeling?
Right now, good. I've got pills for pain, but you're better medicine.
Holly is standing in the doorway, sensible winter coat unzipped, small hands linked at her waist. She's watching them with an unhappy smile. Hodges wouldn't have believed there was such a thing, but apparently there is.
Come on over, Holly, he says. No group hug, I promise. Have you filled Jerome in on this business?
He knows about Barbara's part, but I thought I'd better let you tell the rest.
Jerome briefly cups the back of Hodges' neck with a big warm hand. Holly says you're going into the hospital tomorrow for more tests and a treatment plan, and if you try to argue, I'm supposed to tell you to shut up.
Not shut up, Holly says, looking at Jerome severely. I never used that phrase.
Jerome grins. You had be quiet on your lips, but shut up in your eyes.
Fool,
she says, but the smile returns. Happy we're together, Hodges thinks, sad because of the reason why. He breaks up this strangely pleasant sibling rivalry by asking how Barbara is. Okay. Fractures of the tibia and fibula, mid-shaft. Could have happened on the soccer field or skiing on a bunny slope. Supposed to heal with no problem. She's got a cast and is already complaining about how it itches underneath. Mom went out to get her a scratcher thing.
Holly, did you show her the six-pack?
I did, and she picked out Dr. Babineau. Never even hesitated.
I have a few questions for you, Doc, Hodges thinks, and I intend to get some answers before my last day is over. If I have to squeeze you to get them, make your eyes pop out a little, that will be just fine. Jerome settles on one corner of Hodges' desk, his usual perch.
Run through the whole thing for me, from the beginning. I might see something new.
Hodges does most of the talking. Holly goes to the window and looks out on Lower Marlboro, arms crossed, hands cupping her shoulders. She adds something from time to time, but mostly she just listens. When Hodges is done, Jerome asks,
How sure are you about this mind over matter thing?
Hodges considers. 80%? Maybe more? It's wild, but there are too many stories to discount it.
If he could do it, it's my fault, Holly says without turning from the window. When I hit him with your happy sapper, Bill, it could have rearranged his brain somehow, given him access to the 90% of gray matter we never use.
Maybe, Hodges says, but if you hadn't clobbered him, you and Jerome would be dead.
Along with a lot of other people, Jerome says, and the hit might not have had anything to do with it. Whatever Babineau was feeding him could have done more than bring him out of his coma. Experimental drugs sometimes have unexpected effects, you know.
Or it could have been a combination of the two, Hodges says. He can't believe they're having this conversation. But not to have it would fly in the face of Rule 1 in the detective biz. You go where the facts lead you.
He hated you, Bill, Jerome says. Instead of killing yourself, which is what he wanted, you came after him.
And turned his own weapon against him,
Holly adds, still without turning and still hugging herself.
You used Debbie's blue umbrella to force him into the open. It was him who sent you that message 2 nights ago. I know it was Brady Hartsfield, calling himself Z-Boy.
Now she turns.
It's as plain as the nose on your face. You stopped him at the Mingo.
No, I was downstairs having a heart attack. You were the one who stopped him, Holly.
She shakes her head fiercely.
He doesn't know that, because he never saw me. Do you think I could forget what happened that night? I'll never forget it. Barbara was sitting across the aisle, a few rows up, and it was her he was looking at, not me. I shouted something at him and hit him as soon as he started to turn his head. Then I hit him again. Oh, God, I hit him so hard.
Jerome starts toward her, but she motions him back. Eye contact is hard for her, but now she's looking straight at Hodges, and her eyes are blazing.
You
goaded him out into the open. You were the one who figured out his password so we could crack his computer and find out what he was going to do. You were the one he always blamed. I know that. And then you kept going to his room, sitting there and talking to him.
And you think that's why he did this, whatever this is?
No, she nearly shrieks it. He did it because he was fracking crazy.
There's a pause, and then, in a meek voice, she says she's sorry for raising her voice.
Don't apologize, Holly Berry, Jerome says. You thrill me when you're masterful.
She makes a face at him. Jerome snorts a laugh and asks Hodges about Dinah Scott Zappit.
I'd like a look at it.
My coat pocket, Hodges says, but watch out for the fishing hole demo. Jerome rummages in Hodges' coat, rejects a roll of Tums and the ever-present detective's notebook, and brings out Dinah's green Zappit.
Holy Joe! I thought these things went out with VCRs and dial-up modems.
They pretty much did,
Holly says,
and the price didn't help. I checked. $189, suggested retail, back in 2012. Ridiculous.
Jerome tosses the Zappit from hand to hand. His face is grim, and he looks tired. Well, sure, Hodges thinks. He was building houses in Arizona yesterday. Had to rush home because his normally cheerful sister tried to kill herself. Maybe Jerome sees some of this on Hodges' face.
Barb's leg will be fine. It's her mind I'm a little worried about. She talks about blue flashes and a voice she heard coming from the game.
She says it's still in her head, Holly adds, like some piece of music that turns into an earworm. It will probably pass in time now that her game is broken. But what about the others who got the consoles?
With the bad concert website down, is there any way of finding out how many others did? Holly and Jerome look at each other, then give identical head shakes. Shit, Hodges says. I mean, I'm not all that surprised, but still. Shit.
Does this one give out blue flashes?
Jerome still hasn't turned the Zappit on, just keeps playing hot potato with it. Nope, and the pink fish don't turn into numbers. Try it for yourself.
Instead of doing that, Jerome turns it over and opens the battery compartment. Plain old double A's, he says. The rechargeable kind.
No magic there. But the fishing hole demo really makes you sleepy? It did me, Hodges says. He does not add that he was medicated up the wazoo at the time. Right now I'm more interested in Babineau. He's part of this. I don't understand how that partnership came about, but if he's still alive, he's going to tell us. And there's someone else involved, too.
The man the housekeeper saw, Holly says. The one who drives an old car with the primer spots. Do you want to know what I think?
Hit me.
One of them, either Dr. Babineau or the man with the old car, paid a visit to the nurse, Ruth Scapelli. Hartsfield must have had something against her.
How could he send anyone anywhere? Jerome asks, sliding the battery cover back into place with a click.
Mind control? According to you, Bill, the most he could do with his tele-what's-this was turn on the water in his bathroom, and it's hard for me to accept even that. It could be just so much talk, a hospital legend instead of an urban one.
It has to be the games, Hodges muses. He did something to the games, amped them up somehow.
From his hospital room? Jerome gives him a look that says, be serious. I know, it doesn't make sense, not even if you add in the telekinesis. But it has to be the games. Has to be.
Babineau will know, Holly says.
She's a poet and don't know it, Jerome says moodily. He's still tossing the console back and forth.
Hodges has a feeling that he's resisting an impulse to throw it on the floor and stomp on it, and that's sort of reasonable. After all, one just like it almost got his sister killed. No, Hodges thinks, not just like it. The fishing hole demo on Dinah's Zappit generates a mild hypnotic effect, but nothing else. And it's probably... He straightens suddenly, provoking a twinge of pain in his side. Holly? Have you searched for fishing hole info on the net?
No, she says. I never thought of it.
Would you do it now? What I want to know...
If there's chatter about the demo screen. I should have thought of that myself. I'll do it now. She hurries into the outer office.
What I don't understand, Hodges says, is why Brady would kill himself before seeing how it all came out.
You mean before seeing how many kids he could get to off themselves, Jerome says. Kids who were at that fucking concert. Because that's what we're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, Hodges says. There are too many blank spots, Jerome. Far too many. I don't even know how he killed himself, if he actually did.
Jerome presses the heels of his hands to his temples as if to keep his brain from swelling. Please don't tell me you think he's still alive.
No, he's dead, all right. Pete wouldn't make a mistake about that. What I'm saying is maybe somebody murdered him. Based on what we know, Babineau would be the prime suspect.
Holy poop!
Holly cries from the other room.
Hodges and Jerome happen to be looking at each other when she says it, and there's a moment of divine harmony as they both struggle against laughter.
What? Hodges calls. It's all he can manage without bursting into mad brays of hilarity which would hurt his side as well as Holly's feelings.
I found a site called Fishing Hole Hypnosis. The start page warns parents not to let their kids look at the demo screen too long. It was first noticed in the arcade game version back in 2005. The Game Boy fixed it, but the Zap-It... Wait a sec. They said they did, but they didn't. There's a whole big, long thread.
Hodges looks at Jerome. She means an online conversation, Jerome says.
A kid in Des Moines passed out, hit his head on the edge of his desk, and fractured his skull.
She sounds almost gleeful as she gets up and rushes back to them. Her cheeks are flushed and rosy.
There would have been lawsuits. I bet that's one of the reasons the Zap-It company went out of business. It might even have been one of the reasons why Sunrise Solutions...
The phone on her desk begins to ring.
Oh, frack, she says, turning toward it.
Tell whoever it is that we're closed today. But after saying hello, you've reached Finders Keepers, Holly just listens. Then she turns, holding out the handset.
It's Pete Huntley. He says he has to talk to you right away, and he sounds funny. Like he's sad or mad or something.
Hodges goes into the outer office to find out what's got Pete sounding sad or mad or something. Behind him, Jerome finally powers up Dinah Scott Zap-It.
In Freddie Linklater's computer nest, Freddie herself has taken 4 Excedrin and gone to sleep in her bedroom. 44 found changes to 45 found. The repeater flashes loading. Then it flashes task complete. 16. Pete doesn't say hello. What he says is, take it, Kerm. Take it and beat it until the truth falls out. Bitch is in the house with a couple of skids and I'm out back in a, whatever it is, potting shed, I think, and it's cold as hell.
Hodges is at first too surprised to answer. And not because a pair of skids, the city cop's acronym for State Criminal Investigation Division Detectives, is on some scene Pete is working. He's surprised, in truth almost flabbergasted, because in all their long association, he's only heard Pete use the B-word in connection with an actual woman a single time. That was when speaking of his mother-in-law, who urged Pete's wife to leave and took her in, along with the children, when she finally did. The bitch he's talking about this time can only be his partner, a.k.a. Miss Pretty Gray Eyes.
Kermit, are you there?
I'm here, Hodges says. Where are you?
Sugar Heights. Dr. Felix Babineau's house on Scenic Lilac Drive.
Hell, his fucking estate. You know who Babineau is. I know you do.
No one kept closer tabs on Brady Hartsfield than you. For a while there, he was your fucking hobby.
Who you're talking about, yes. What you're talking about, no.
This whole thing is going to blow up, partner, and Izzy doesn't want to get hit with the shrapnel when it does. She's got ambitions, see? Chief of detectives in 10 years, maybe chief of police in 15. I get it, but that doesn't mean I like it.
She called Chief Horgan behind my back, and Horgan called the skids.
If it's not officially their case now, it will be by noon. They've got their perp, but the shit's not right. I know it, and Izzy does too. She just doesn't give a rat's ass.
You need to slow down, Pete. Tell me what's going on.
Holly is hovering anxiously. Hodges shrugs his shoulders and raises a finger.
Wait.
Housekeeper gets here at 7:30, okay? Nora Everly, by name. And at the top of the drive,
She sees Babineau's BMW on the lawn, with a bullet hole in the windshield. She looks inside, sees blood on the steering wheel and the seat, calls 911. There's a cop car 5 minutes away. In the Heights, there's always one 5 minutes away. And when it arrives, Everly's sitting in her car with all the doors locked, shaking like a leaf. The unis tell her to stay put and go to the door. The place is unlocked. Mrs. Babineau, Cora, is lying dead in the hall, and I'm sure the bullet the ME digs out of her will match the one forensics dug out of the Beamer. On her forehead, are you ready for this? There's the letter Z in black ink. More all around the downstairs, including one on the TV screen, just like the one at the Ellerton place. And I think it was right about then my partner decided she wanted no part of this particular tar baby. Hodges says, yeah, probably, just to keep Pete talking. He grabs the pad beside Holly's computer and prints Babineau's wife murdered in big black letters, like a newspaper headline. Her hand flies to her mouth. While one of the cops is calling division, the other one hears snores coming from upstairs, like a chainsaw on idle, he said. So they go up, guns drawn, and in one of the three guest bedrooms, count them, three, the place is fucking huge, they find an old fart fast asleep. They wake him up, and he gives his name as Alvin Brooks. Library Al, Hodges shouts, from the hospital. The first Zappit I ever saw was one he showed me. Yeah. That's the guy. He had a Kiner ID badge in his shirt pocket, and without prompting, he says he killed Mrs. Babineau, claims he did it while he was hypnotized. So they cuff him, take him downstairs, and sit him on the couch. That's where Izzy and me found him when we entered the scene half an hour or so later. I don't know what's wrong with the guy, whether he had a nervous breakdown or what, but he's on Planet Purple. He keeps going off on tangents, spouting all sorts of weird shit. Hodges recollects something Al said to him on one of his last visits to Brady's room, right around Labor Day weekend of 2014, that would have been. Never so good as what you don't see. Yeah, Pete sounds surprised. Like that. And when Izzy asked who hypnotized him, he said it was the fish. The ones by the beautiful sea. To Hodges, this now makes sense. On further questioning, I did it. By then, Izzy must have been in the kitchen, busy ditching the whole thing without asking for my input. He said Dr. Z told him to, I quote, make his mark 10 times, he said. And sure enough, there are 10 Zs, including the one on the deceased's forehead. I asked him if Dr. Z was Dr. Babineau, and he said no, Dr. Z was Brady Hartsfield. Crazy, see? Yeah, Hodges says. I asked him if he shot Dr. Babineau, too. He just shook his head and said he wanted to go back to sleep. Right around then, Izzy comes tripping back from the kitchen and says Chief Horgan called the skids on account of Dr. B is a high-profile guy, and this is going to be a high-profile case, and besides, a pair of them happen to be right here in the city waiting to be called to testify in a case. Isn't that convenient? She won't meet my eye. She's all flushed. And when I start pointing around at all the Z's, asking her if they don't look familiar, she won't talk about it. Hodges has never heard such anger and frustration in his old partner's voice. So then my cell rings, and you remember when I reached out to you this morning, I said the doc on call took a sample of the residue in Hartsfield's mouth, before the ME guy even got there? Yeah. Well, the phone call was from that doc. Simonson, his name is. The ME's analysis won't be back for 2 days at the soonest, but Simonson did one right away. The stuff in Hartsfield's mouth was a combination of Vicodin and Ambien. Hartsfield wasn't prescribed either one, and he could hardly dance his way down to the nearest med locker and score some, could he? Hodges, who already knows what Brady was taking for pain, agrees that that would be unlikely. Right now, Izzy's in the house, probably watching them from the background and keeping her mouth shut while the skids question this Brooks guy who, honest to God, can't remember his own name unless he's prompted. Otherwise, he calls himself Z-Boy, like something out of a Marvel comic book. Clutching the pen in his hand almost hard enough to snap it in two, Hodges prints more headline caps on the pad with Holly bending over to read as he writes,
Library Al left the message on Debbie's blue umbrella. Holly stares at him with wide eyes.
Just before the skids arrived, man, they didn't take long, I asked Brooks if he also killed Brady Hartsfield. Izzy says to him,
"Don't answer that."
She said, "What?" Hodges exclaims. He doesn't have much room in his head right now to worry about Pete's deteriorating relationship with his partner, but he's still amazed. Izzy's a police detective, after all, not Library Al's defense attorney.
You heard me. Then she looks at me and says, "You haven't given him the words." So I turn to one of the uniforms and ask, "Did you guys Mirandize this gentleman?" And of course they say, "Yeah." I look at Izzy, and she's redder in the face than ever. But she won't back down. She says, "If we fuck this up, it won't come back on you. You're done in another couple of weeks, but it'll come back on me, and hard."
So the state boys turn up.
Yeah.
And now I'm out here in the late Mrs. Babineau's potting shed, or whatever the fuck it is, freezing my ass off.
The richest part of the city, Kerm, and I'm in a shack colder than a well digger's belt buckle.
I bet Izzy knows I'm calling you too, tattling to my dear old Uncle Kermit.
Pete is probably right about that, but if Miss Pretty Gray Eyes is as set on climbing the ladder as Pete believes, she's probably thinking of an uglier word, snitching.
This Brooks guy is out of whatever little mind he's got left, which makes him the perfect donkey to pin the tail on when this hits the media. You know how they're going to lay it out?
Hodges does, but lets Pete say it.
Brooks got it in his head that he was some avenger of justice called Z-Boy. He came here, he killed Mrs. Babineau when she opened the door, then killed the doc himself when Babineau got in his beamer and tried to flee. Brooks then drove to the hospital and fed Hartsfield a bunch of pills from the Babineau's private stash. I don't doubt that part, because they had a fucking pharmacy in their medicine cabinet. And sure, he could have gotten up to the brain injury clinic without any problem. He's got an ID card, and he's been a hospital fixture for the last 6 or 7 years. But why? And what did he do with Babineau's body? Because it's not here.
Good question. Pete plunges on.
They'll say Brooks loaded it into his own car and ditched it somewhere, probably in a ravine or a culvert, and probably when he was coming back from feeding Hartsfield those pills. But why do that when he left the woman's body lying right there in the hall? And why come back here in the first place?
They'll say,
yeah, that he's crazy. Sure they will. Perfect answer for anything that doesn't make sense. And if Ellerton and Stover come up at all, which they probably won't, they'll say he killed them too.
If they do, Hodges thinks, Nancy Alderson will backstop the story, at least to a degree, because it was undoubtedly Library Al that she saw watching the house on Hilltop Court.
They'll hang Brooks out to dry, wade through the press coverage and call it good. But there's more to it, Kerm. Gotta be. If you know anything, if you've got even a single thread to pull, pull it. Promise me you will.
I have more than one, Hodges thinks, but Babineau's the key, and Babineau has disappeared. How much blood was in the car, Pete?
Not a lot, but forensics has already confirmed it's Babineau's type. That's not conclusive, but...
Shit, I gotta go. Izzy and one of the skid guys just came out the back door. They're looking for me.
All right.
Call me. And if you need anything I can access, let me know.
I will.
Hodges ends the call and looks up, wanting to fill Holly in, but Holly is no longer beside him.
Bill, her voice is low. Come in here. Puzzled, he walks to the door of his office, where he stops dead.
Jerome is behind the desk, sitting in Hodges' swivel chair. His long legs are splayed out, and he's looking at Dinah Scott Zappit. His eyes are wide open, but empty. His mouth hangs ajar. There are fine drops of spittle on his lower lip. A tune is tinkling from the gadget's tiny speaker, but not the same tune as last night. Hodges is sure of it.
Jerome?
He takes a step forward, but before he can take another, Holly grabs him by the belt. Her grip is surprisingly strong.
No, she says in the same low voice. You shouldn't startle him. Not when he's like that.
What then?
I had a year of hypnotherapy when I was in my 30s. I was having problems with... Well, never mind what I was having problems with. Let me try.
Are you sure?
She looks at him,
her face now pale, her eyes fearful.
No, but we can't leave him like that. Not after what happened to Barbara.
The zappet in Jerome's limp hands gives off a bright blue flash. Jerome doesn't react, doesn't blink, only continues staring at the screen while the music tinkles. Holly takes a step forward, then another.
Jerome.
No answer.
Jerome, can you hear me?
Yes, Jerome says, not looking up from the screen.
Jerome, where are you?
And Jerome says, at my funeral. Everyone is there. It's beautiful. 17. Brady became fascinated with suicide at the age of 12, while reading Raven, a true crime book about the mass suicides in Jonestown, Guyana. There, more than 900 people, a third of them children, died after drinking fruit juice laced with cyanide. What interested Brady, aside from the thrillingly high body count, was the lead-up to the final orgy. Long before the day when whole families swallowed the poison together and nurses, actual nurses, used hypodermics to squirt death down the throats of squalling infants, Jim Jones was preparing his followers for their apotheosis with fiery sermons and suicide rehearsals he called White Nights. He first filled them with paranoia, then hypnotized them with the glamour of death. As a senior, Brady wrote his only A paper for a half-assed sociology class called American Life. The paper was called American Death Ways, a brief study of suicide in the U.S. In it, he cited the statistics for 1999, then the most recent year for which they were available. More than 40,000 people had killed themselves during that year, usually with guns, the most reliable go-to method, but with pills running a close second. They also hung themselves, drowned themselves, bled out, stuck their heads in gas ovens, set themselves on fire, and rammed their cars into bridge abutments. One inventive fellow, this Brady did not put into his report, even then he was careful not to be branded an oddity, stuck a 220-volt line up his rectum and electrocuted himself. In 1999, suicide was the 10th leading cause of death in America, and if you added in the ones that were reported as accidents or natural causes, it would undoubtedly be right up there with heart disease, cancer, and car crashes, most likely still behind them, but not far behind. Brady quoted Albert Camus, who said, "There is but one truly serious philosophical problem, and that is suicide." He also quoted a famous psychiatrist named Raymond Katz, who stated flatly, "Every human being is born with a suicide gene." Brady did not bother to add the second part of Katz's statement because he felt it took some of the drama out of it. In most of us, it remains dormant. In the 10 years between his graduation from high school and that disabling moment in the Mingo Auditorium, Brady's fascination with suicide, including his own, always seen as part of some grand and historic gesture, continued. This seed has now, against all the odds, fully blossomed. He will be the Jim Jones of the 21st century. 18. 40 miles north of the city, he can wait no longer. Brady pulls into a rest area on I-47, kills the laboring engine of Z-Boy's Malibu, and powers up Babineau's laptop. There's no Wi-Fi here, as there is at some rest areas, but thanks to Big Mama Verizon, there's a cell tower not 4 miles away, standing tall against the thickening clouds. Using Babineau's MacBook Air, he can go anywhere he wants and never have to leave this nearly deserted parking lot. He thinks, and not for the first time, that a touch of telekinesis is nothing compared to the power of the Internet. He's sure thousands of suicides have incubated in the potent soup of its social media sites, where the trolls run free and the bullying goes on endlessly. That's real mind over matter. He's not able to type as fast as he'd like to, The damp air pushing in with the coming storm has worsened the arthritis in Babineau's fingers, but eventually the laptop is mated to the high-powered gear back in Freddy Linklater's computer room. He won't have to stay mated to it for long. He clicks on a hidden file he placed on the laptop during one of his previous visits inside Babineau's head. Open link to Z the end? Y, N. He centers the cursor on Y, hits the return key, then waits. The worry circle goes around and around and around. Just as he's begun to wonder if something has gone wrong, the laptop flashes the message he's been waiting for. Z the end is now active. Good. Z the end is just a little icing on the cake. He has been able to disseminate only a limited number of Zappets, and a significant portion of his shipment was defective, for Christ's sake. But teenagers are herd creatures, and herd creatures are in mental and emotional lockstep. It's why fish school and bees swarm. It's why the swallows come back each year to Capistrano. In human behavior, it's why the wave goes around at football and baseball stadiums, and why individuals will lose themselves in a crowd simply because the crowd is there. Teenage boys have a tendency to wear the same baggy shorts and grow the same scruff on their faces, lest they be excluded from the herd. Teenage girls adopt the same styles of dress and go crazy for the same musical groups. It's "We Are Your Brothers" this year. Not so long ago it was "Round Here" and "One Direction." Back in the day it was "New Kids on the Block." Fads sweep through teenagers like a measles epidemic, and from time to time, one of those fads is suicide. In southern Wales, dozens of teens hung themselves between 2007 and 2009 with messages on social networking sites stoking the craze. Even the goodbyes they left were couched in NetSpeak, "Me Too," and "See You Later." Wildfires vast enough to burn millions of acres can be started by a single match thrown into dry brush. The Zappets Brady has distributed through his human drones are hundreds of matches. Not all of them will light, and some of those that do won't stay lit. Brady knows this, but he has ztheend.com to serve as both backstop and accelerant. Will it work? He's far from sure. But time is too short for extensive tests. And if it does? Teen suicides all over the state. Maybe all over the Midwest. Hundreds. Perhaps thousands. How would you like that, ex-Detective Hodges? Would that improve your retirement, you meddlesome old fuck? He swaps Babineau's laptop for Z-Boy's game console. It's fitting to use this one. He thinks of it as Zappet Zero, because it's the first one he ever saw, on the day Al Brooks brought it into his room, thinking Brady might like it, which he did. Oh yes, very much. The extra program, with the number fish and the subliminal messages, hasn't been added to this one, because Brady doesn't need it. Those things are strictly for the targets. He watches the fish swim back and forth, using them to settle and focus, then closes his eyes. At first there's only darkness, but after a few moments, red lights begin to appear. More than 50 now. They are like dots on a computer map, except they don't remain stationary. They swim back and forth, left to right, up and down, crisscrossing. He settles on one at random, his eyes rolling beneath his closed lids as he follows its progress. It begins to slow, and slow, and slow. It stills, then starts growing bigger. It opens like a flower. He's in a bedroom. There's a girl staring fixedly down at the fish on her own Zappet, which she received free from badconcert.com. She's in her bed, because she didn't go to school today. Maybe she said she was sick. "What's your name?" Brady asks. Sometimes they just hear a voice coming from the game console. But the ones who are most susceptible actually see him, like some kind of avatar in a video game. This girl is one of the latter, an auspicious beginning. But they always respond better to their names, so he'll keep saying it. She looks without surprise at the young man sitting beside her on the bed. Her face is pale, her eyes are dazed. "I'm Ellen," she says. "I'm looking for the right numbers." "Of course you are," he thinks, and slips into her. She's 40 miles south of him, but once the demo screen has opened them, distance doesn't matter. He could control her, turn her into one of his drones, but he doesn't want to do that any more than he wanted to slip into Mrs. Trelawney's house some dark night and cut her throat. Murder isn't control. Murder is just murder. Suicide is control. "Are you happy, Ellen?"
"I used to be," she says. "I could be again if I find the right numbers."
Brady gives her a smile that's both sad and charming.
"Yes, but the numbers are like life," he says. "Nothing adds up, Ellen. Isn't that true?"
"Uh-huh."
"Tell me something, Ellen. What are you worried about?"
He could find it himself, but it will be better if she tells him. He knows there's something, because everyone worries, and teenagers worry most of all.
"Right now? The SAT.
"Aha," he thinks. "The infamous Scholastic Assessment Test, where the Department of Academic Husbandry separates the sheep from the goats."
"I'm so bad at math," she says. "I reek."
"Bad at the numbers," he says, nodding sympathetically.
"If I don't score at least 650, I won't get into a good school."
"And you'll be lucky to score 400, he says. "Isn't that the truth, Ellen?"
"Yes."
Tears well in her eyes and begin to roll down her cheeks.
"And then you'll do badly on the English, too," Brady says. He's opening her up, and this is the best part. It's like reaching into an animal that's stunned, but still alive, and digging its guts out. "You'll freeze up."
"I'll probably freeze up,"
Ellen says. She's sobbing audibly now. Brady checks her short-term memory and finds that her parents have gone to work and her little brother is at school, so crying is all right. Let the bitch make all the noise she wants.
"Not probably. You will freeze up, Ellen, because you can't handle the pressure." She sobs. "Say it, Ellen."
"I can't handle the pressure. I'll freeze. And if I don't get into a good school, my dad will be disappointed and my mother will be mad."
"What if you can't get into any school? What if the only job you can get is cleaning houses or folding clothes in a laundromat?"
"My mother will hate me."
"She hates you already, doesn't she, Ellen?"
I don't think...
"Yes, she does. She hates you. Say it, Ellen. Say... My mother hates me."
"My mother hates me. Oh, God. I'm so scared, and my life is so awful."
This is the great gift bestowed by a combination of Zapit-induced hypnosis and Brady's own ability to invade minds once they are in that open and suggestible state. Ordinary fears, the ones kids like this live with as a kind of unpleasant background noise, can be turned into ravening monsters. Small balloons of paranoia can be inflated until they are as big as floats in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. "You could stop being scared," Brady says, "and you could make your mother very, very sorry." Ellen smiles through her tears. "You could leave all this behind."
"I could. I could leave it behind."
"You could be at peace."
"Peace,"
she says, and sighs. How wonderful this is. It took weeks with Martine Stover's mother, who was always leaving the demo screen to play her goddamn solitaire, and days with Barbara Robinson. With Ruth Scapelli and this pimple-faced crybaby in her poofy pink girl's bedroom? Mere minutes. But then, Brady thinks, I always had a steep learning curve. Do you have your phone, Ellen?
Here.
She reaches under a decorative throw pillow. Her phone is also poofy pink. You should post on Facebook and Twitter, so all your friends can read it.
What should I post?
Say, I am at peace now. You can be too. Go to ztheend.com. She does it, but at an oozingly slow speed. When they're in this state, it's like they're underwater. Brady reminds himself of how well this is going and tries not to become impatient. When she's done and the messages are sent, more matches flicked into dry tinder, he suggests that she go to the window. I think you could use some fresh air. It might clear your head.
I could use some fresh air,
she says, throwing back the duvet and swinging her bare feet out of bed. Don't forget your zappet, he says. She takes it and walks to the window. Before you open the window, go to the main screen where the icons are. Can you do that, Ellen?
Yes.
A long pause. The bitch is slower than cold molasses.
Okay, I see the icons.
Great. Now go to wipe words. It's the blackboard and eraser icon.
I see it.
Tap it twice, Ellen. She does so, and the zappet gives an acknowledging blue flash. If anyone tries to use this particular game console again, it will give a final blue flash and drop dead.
Now,
you can open the window. Cold air rushes in, blowing her hair back. She wavers, seems on the edge of waking, and for a moment, Brady feels her slipping away. Control is still hard to maintain at a distance, even when they're in a hypnotic state, but he's sure he'll hone his technique to a nice sharp point. Practice makes perfect. Jump, Brady whispers. Jump, and you won't have to take the SAT. Your mother won't hate you. She'll be sorry. Jump, and all the numbers will come right. You'll get the best prize. The prize is sleep.
The prize is sleep,
Ellen agrees. Do it now, Brady murmurs as he sits behind the wheel of Al Brooks' old car with his eyes closed. 40 miles south, Ellen jumps from her bedroom window. It's not a long drop, and there's banked snow against the house. It's old and crusty, but it still cushions her fall to a degree, so instead of dying, she only breaks a collarbone and 3 ribs. She begins to scream in pain, and Brady is blown out of her head like a pilot strapped to an F-111 ejection seat. Shit! He screams and pounds the steering wheel. Babineau's arthritis flares all the way up his arm, and that makes him angrier still. Shit! 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 19. In the pleasantly upscale neighborhood of Branson Park, Ellen Murphy struggles to her feet. The last thing she remembers is telling her mother she was too sick to go to school. A lie so she could tap pink fish and hunt for prizes on the pleasantly addictive fishing hole demo. Her zappet is lying nearby, the screen cracked. It no longer interests her. She leaves it and begins staggering toward the front door on bare feet. Each breath she takes is a stab in the side. But I'm alive, she thinks. At least I'm alive. What was I thinking? What in God's name was I thinking? Brady's voice is still with her. The slimy taste of something awful that she swallowed while it was still alive. 20.
Jerome,
Holly asks,
can you still hear me?
Yes.
I want you to turn off the zappet and put it on Bill's desk.
And then, because she's always been a belt and suspenders kind of girl, she adds,
face down.
A frown creases his broad brow. Do I have to?
Yes, right now, and without looking at the damn thing.
Before Jerome can follow this order, Hodges catches one final glimpse of the fish swimming and one more bright blue flash. A momentary dizziness, perhaps caused by his pain pills, perhaps not, sweeps through him. Then Jerome pushes the button on top of the console, and the fish disappear. What Hodges feels isn't relief, but disappointment. Maybe that's crazy, but given his current medical problem, maybe it's not. He's seen hypnosis used from time to time to help witnesses achieve better recall, but has never grasped its full power until now. He has an idea, probably blasphemous in this situation, that the Zap-It fish might be better medicine for pain than the stuff Dr. Stamos prescribed. Holly says,
I'm going to count down from 10 to 1, Jerome. Each time you hear a number, you'll be a little more awake. Okay?
For several seconds, Jerome says nothing. He sits calmly, peacefully, touring some other reality, and perhaps trying to decide if he would like to live there permanently. Holly, on the other hand, is vibrating like a tuning fork, and Hodges can feel his fingernails biting into his palms as he clenches his fists. At last, Jerome says,
Okay, I guess, since it's you, Holly Berry.
Here we go. 10, 9, 8. You're coming back. 7, 6, 5. Waking up.
Jerome raises his head. His eyes are aimed at Hodges, but Hodges isn't sure the boy is seeing him.
4, 3. Almost there. 2, 1.
Wake up! She claps her hands together. Jerome gives a hard jerk. One hand brushes Dinah's Zap-It and knocks it to the floor. Jerome looks at Holly with an expression of surprise so exaggerated it would be funny under other circumstances.
What just happened? Did I go to sleep?
Holly collapses into the chair ordinarily reserved for clients. She takes a deep breath and wipes her cheeks, which are damp with sweat. In a way, Hodges says, the game hypnotized you, like it hypnotized your sister.
Are you sure? Jerome asks, then looks at his watch. I guess you are. I just lost 15 minutes.
Closer to 20. What do you remember?
Tapping the pink fish and turning them into numbers. It's surprisingly hard to do. You have to watch closely, really concentrate, and the blue flashes don't help.
Hodges picks the Zap-It up off the floor.
I wouldn't turn that on,
Holly says sharply. Not going to. But I did last night, and I can tell you there were no blue flashes, and you could tap pink fish until your finger went numb without getting any numbers. Also, the tune is different now. Not much, but a little.
Holly sings, pitch perfect. By the sea, by the sea, by the beautiful sea, you and me, you and me, oh, how happy we'll be.
My mother used to sing it to me when I was little.
Jerome is staring at her with more intensity than she can deal with, and she looks away flustered.
What? What is it?
There were words, he says, but not those. Hodges heard no words, only the tune, but doesn't say so. Holly asks Jerome if he can remember them. His pitch isn't as good as hers, but it's close enough for them to be sure that, yes, it's the tune they heard.
You can sleep. You can sleep. It's a beautiful sleep.
He stops. That's all I can remember. If I'm not just making it up, that is.
Holly says, Now, we know for sure. Someone amped the fishing hole screen.
Shot it full of roids, Jerome adds. What does that even mean? Hodges asks. Jerome nods to Holly, and she says,
Someone loaded a stealth program into the demo, which is mildly hypnotic to begin with. The program was dormant when Dinah had the Zap-It, and still dormant when you looked at it last night, Bill, which was lucky for you. But someone turned it on after that.
Babineau?
Him or someone else. If the police are right, and Babineau is dead.
It could have been a preset, Jerome says to Holly,
then to Hodges. You know, like an alarm clock. Let me get this straight, Hodges says. The program was in there all along and only became active once Dinah's Zap-It was turned on today?
Yes, Holly says. There's probably a repeater at work, don't you think, Jerome?
Yeah, a computer program that pumps out the update constantly, waiting for some schlub, me in this case, to turn on a Zap-It and activate the Wi-Fi. This could happen with all of them? If the stealth program is in all of them, sure, Jerome says. Brady set this up. Hodges begins to pace, hand going to his side as if to contain the pain and hold it in. Brady fucking Hartsfield.
How?
Holly asks. I don't know, but it's the only thing that fits. He tries to blow up the Mingo during that concert. We stop him. The audience, most of them young girls, is saved.
By you, Holly, Jerome says.
Be quiet, Jerome. Let him tell it.
Her eyes suggest she knows where Hodges is going. 6 years pass. Those young girls, most of them in elementary or middle school in 2010, are in high school, maybe in college. Around here is long gone, and the girls are young women now. They've moved on to other kinds of music, but then they get an offer they can't refuse. A free game console, and all they have to do is be able to prove they were at the Round Here show that night. The console probably looks as out of date to them as a black and white TV, but what the hell, it's free.
Yes, Holly says.
Brady was still after them. This is his revenge. But not just on them. It's his revenge on you, Bill.
Which makes me responsible, Hodges thinks bleakly. Except what else could I do? What else could any of us do? He was going to bomb the place. Babineau, going under the name of Myron Zakum, bought 800 of those consoles. It had to be him because he's loaded. Brady was broke, and I doubt Library Al could have fronted even $20,000 from his retirement savings. Those consoles are out there now. And if they all get this amped-up program once they're turned on...
Hold it. Go back, Jerome says. Are you really saying that a respected neurosurgeon got involved in this shit?
That's what I'm saying, yeah. Your sister ID'd him. And we already know the respected neurosurgeon was using Brady Hartsfield as a lab rat.
But now, Hartsfield's dead, Holly says. Which leaves Babineau, who may also be dead.
Or not, Hodges says. There was blood in his car, but no body. Wouldn't be the first time some doer tried to fake his own death.
I've got to check something on my computer, Holly says. If those free Zap-Its are getting a new program as of today, then maybe she hurries out.
Jerome begins. I don't understand how any of this can be, but Babineau will be able to tell us, Hodges says, if he's still alive.
Yes, but wait a minute. Barb talked about hearing a voice, telling her all sorts of awful things. I didn't hear any voice, and I sure don't feel like offing myself.
Maybe you're immune.
I'm not. That screen got me, Bill. I mean, I was gone. I heard words in the little tune, and I think there were words in the blue flashes, too. Like subliminal messages, but no voice.
There could be all sorts of reasons for that, Hodges thinks. And just because Jerome didn't hear the suicide voice, it doesn't mean that most of the kids who got those free games won't. Let's say this repeater gadget was only turned on during the last 14 hours, Hodges says. We know it can't have been earlier than when I tried out Dinah's game, or I would have seen the number fish and the blue flashes. So here's a question. Can those demo screens be amped up even if the gadgets are off?
No way, Jerome says. They have to be turned on. But once they are...
It's active! Holly shouts. That fracking Z, the Insight, is active!
Jerome rushes to her desk in the outer office. Hodges follows more slowly. Holly turns up the volume on her computer, and music fills the offices of Finders Keepers. Not by the beautiful sea this time, but Don't Fear the Reaper. As it spools out, 40,000 men and women every day, another 40,000 coming every day, Hodges sees a candlelit funeral parlor, and a coffin buried in flowers.
Above it, smiling young men and women come and go, moving side to side, crisscrossing, fading,